And now, from Washington, the Inside Scoop. All the news the government does not want you to hear. Now, here's your host on the Inside Scoop, Mark Levine.
Good evening, America. Welcome to the Inside Scoop. In the midst of the horror at Virginia Tech and America's disbelief at the testimony of Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez, we may have missed one of the most important Supreme Court decisions of our time. The decision is Carhart v. Gonzalez, and it changes abortion law in quite a dramatic way. In 2003, Congress passed the 2003 Partial Birth Abortion Act, and it would outlaw a number of procedures that have been practiced for a long time. To understand that act, you really have to go through and understand a little bit about abortion law and abortion procedure. And I'm going to spend the entire hour discussing this decision, abortion law, abortion procedure, and where we go from here, where the law goes from here. To discuss these matters, I've invited people from all different perspectives. One is Judy Brown. She's the president of the American Life Lobby. Do we have Judy on the air?
Yes. Hello.
Oh, good. You are on the air. That's terrific. We also have in studio Jim Southworth. Jim Southworth is the CEO of Fairfax Channel 10, but he comes on this time as a father, a parent, someone who underwent a troubling birth some 25 years ago that he's going to talk about. I will get to both Judy and Jim in a minute, but first I want to go over abortion law and medical procedure. According to the Supreme Court opinion, and yes, I have read all 70-plus pages of it, according to Justice Kennedy, who's in the majority, and Justice Ginsburg, who's in the dissent, basically it works something like this. 85 to 90% of abortions in America are done in the first trimester, before a fetus is viable, and most of them are done via a vacuum-like procedure. The act passed by Congress does not purport to change that early abortion procedure. But second trimester abortions is what largely is what we're talking about here. And there are several ways that Justice Kennedy points out you can have a second trimester abortion. Now, second trimester abortions, it should be clear, sometimes the fetus is viable and sometimes the fetus is not viable. That's an important distinction because Roe v. Wade, the first abortion bill, made such a distinction. According to all abortion law before the decision last week, if a fetus is not viable, in other words, the fetus cannot live outside his or her mother's womb, then you can have an abortion without restrictions. And after viability, after a fetus can live outside a mother's womb, then prior to this decision, the state could regulate abortion, except in cases where the mother's life was in danger or the mother's health was in danger. This decision, which upheld the congressional law, changed the law in two distinct ways. One, there's no longer a health exception for the woman. What that means is that even if the woman's health is in danger, you can still prohibit an abortion by using this particular procedure. Also, it doesn't matter whether the fetus is viable or not viable, the procedure is still prohibited. Let me explain a little bit about the procedures, and then I will give everyone lots of time. Judy Brown can tell me if she agrees or disagrees, but I'm trying to really stick to the opinions and where both the opinion by Justice Kennedy and the dissent by Justice Ginsburg agreed. So 85 to 90% of abortions are first term. Then of those that are in the second trimester, there's a procedure that was banned called the doctors call D&E, dilation and extraction. And the Congress uses the term partial birth abortion. This is not a term used by doctors, but it is the term used in the act. And basically, according to Justice Kennedy, this is restricted to intact D&E. Now, this is complex here, but it's really not that hard to understand. There's intact D&E and non-intact D&E. In a non-intact D&E, the doctor sticks forceps into a woman vaginally and basically chops up the fetus and then pulls it out part by part. Now, at this point, as in the second trimester, the fetus can have bones, chips that can remain in and cause all kinds of complications for the woman. In intact D&E, the one that's banned by this law, basically the doctor tries very carefully to pull the fetus out in one group, and then when the head is left inside the womb, the doctor stabs the skull of the fetus to deflate it to get it out of the woman. This is the way that causes the least health complications for the woman, according to many doctors. There are other ways, though, that Justice Kennedy points out. One is to poison the fetus so that it dies inside the womb and can be pulled out. And then the other ways are to actually give birth to the fetus, which require a hospital stay and can cause damage. And then in very, very rare cases, cesarean and hysterectomy. Basically, what the act does is it prohibits intact DNA, which many doctors say is the most healthful way to do an abortion for a woman. So in essence, as I see the opinion, and again, I'm going to give my guests lots of time, what this law does is it prohibits a method of abortion. It doesn't save a single fetus, because a woman can still have an abortion by another method, but by methods that are more unhealthful to the woman. So the act does not save a single fetus, but it does cause women to incur more health consequences. It seems strange for that reason. Now I'd like to talk to both of my guests. First, Judy Brown, the president of the American Life Lobby. I'd like to know how you saw my recitation of the law, if you agree or disagree. If you disagree, that's fine. Tell me why and what you think of the Supreme Court opinion.
Well, let me first point out to you that in Justice Kennedy's opinion, he makes it very clear that the doctor is not allowed to do this procedure that you have described as partial birth abortion unless he feels it is necessary to save the life of the mother.
That's correct.
That's right there in the opinion.
Yeah, that's correct. Let me be fair, and Judy Brown is absolutely right. The law does have an exception for the life of the mother. It does not
right.
have an exception for the health of the mother. She's absolutely right to make that distinction. Please go on.
Okay, and then Justice Kennedy describes what you said is a not intact DNA, which is, first of all, as Justice Kennedy points out, giving the baby an injection in the baby's heart, and that renders the fetus, the baby, dead. And then the doctor can remove the fetus, depending on the size of the fetus, either by cutting him up or not. I mean, it is possible if the baby is totally underdeveloped that he would be able to deliver that baby without doing any kind of slicing and dicing.
That's true, although, and you're absolutely right about that. One of the things that Justice Ginsburg points out in her dissenting opinion is that for some women, that kind of poison in the fetus is contraindicated. In other words, some women can't handle that to their system. I talked to a doctor just recently who said that women who are pregnant, their immune system is down, actually, because there's another life inside of her. And so for some women, that poison would be very dangerous for the woman. But you're absolutely right, Judy Brown, for some women, that certainly could be done. Tell me, what's your view in general of the Supreme Court opinion?
Well, as you know, I'm a pro-life leader. And
right.
as I read this decision, I was totally discouraged by the court. Because for the first time in 34 years, this court described how you could do the very procedure they claimed to be banning, and then they described exactly how to abort that same preborn baby in a different way. And to my mind, this decision is so narrowly drawn that it reaffirms Casey, it reaffirms Roe, and actually, as you said, will not save a single baby.
So what's interesting is that I think this opinion is criticized by both pro-choice and pro-life. I mean, it's interesting that Judy and I agree. It doesn't save, it doesn't, you know, prohibit an abortion. It does prohibit a method of abortion.
Yes.
That in some instances where a woman can't take the poison that would kill the fetus, in that particular instance, would actually be more dangerous because basically a doctor has to stick a forceps inside a woman vaginally 10 or 15 times. There could be bone chips. There could be remains of the fetus, which would cause all kinds of complications, infection, perhaps infertility to the woman in the future. So it's interesting to me that people like yourself, Judy, and I, and I'm going to get to Jim Southworth in a minute, but basically you can condemn the opinion, or at least it's really the bill we're talking about here. You can condemn it from all angles here. What would you like to see in place of the Partial Birth Abortion Act of 2003? Would it be a complete ban on all abortions?
The reason that American Life League exists is the goal of ending all surgical, medical, and chemical abortions. In other words, we believe that the preborn fetus baby is a human being who should have equal rights under the law.
Now, Judy, I know that you would say, I assume life begins at conception?
We believe and know scientifically that human beings' life begins at the instant that person begins at fertilization, which is also described as conception.
Okay, so I'm just trying to understand, does your organization also want to prohibit birth control, which would be preconception, sperm in the egg? Does your organization
That's
take a position
correct.
On that?
If we were to have the court or the Congress protect all persons from the moment their lives begin, any chemical or device-oriented contraceptive that worked against implantation would be outlawed, and so would in vitro fertilization.
Okay, so that's a lot of contraception as well. How about things like condoms and the birth control pill?
The birth control pill does cause abortion, and so that would be outlawed. The condom does not, so it would not be outlawed.
So condoms would be the one method of birth control that your organization would continue to support?
Well, we wouldn't support any kind of contraception. What I'm trying to tell you is that that particular kind of birth control would not be outlawed.
Okay. Do you see this decision as a path down the road to overturning Roe v. Wade?
Absolutely not.
Why
no,
not?
I don't.
Because it reaffirmed the holding that a woman could still have an abortion.
No, because it described how abortions can be done and when they can be done, including the partial birth abortion.
In your view, is a not intact DNA where they because the is that a partial birth abortion? The reason I ask is because Congress defined it as, it's a very interesting definition. It basically, if you pull out the legs and you go past the navel, that's what makes it illegal. If you don't go past the navel, it's not illegal. So in other words, you can pull out the legs and then chop up the baby inside and then it's legal, but if you pull it out past the navel, it's not illegal. Does that definition make sense to you, Judy?
That does not make any sense to me. Because truly, if the court were going to ban second trimester abortions, and that was their goal, that is what they would have done. This court tried to give, in my opinion, a Pontius Pilate decision, and they succeeded in doing that.
And to be clear, what the court was doing was affirming a law passed by Congress. This was passed by Congress prior to the Democratic takeover, when the Republicans controlled both houses of Congress.
Right.
President Bush signed it into law. I actually worked on the Judiciary Committee at the time this bill was passed. When we come back, I'll tell you about my own experiences where we tried to amend this bill and did not succeed. Also, when we come back, my other guest, Jim Southworth, will talk. Now, Jim, although the head of Channel 10 is coming on, really is someone with a story to tell about why he wishes that his wife in 1981 could have had what Congress has called a partial birth abortion. We'll be right back with his story right after this.
You're probably still there with us,
History
Judy, right?
History has demonstrated that violence only begets greater violence. And injustice only begets greater injustice. This is not the tradition of our great nation. This is not how we want the United States to be known around the world. We have another tradition that we think ought to prevail. One that is more just and more powerful. There is a better way. If we truly want peace and security, then we must work hard for justice.
If you're concerned that we've become a nation whose national policies are grounded in beliefs that are centered on a lie embedded in BS, then don't miss Escape from Orwellianation, a talk show in which concerned regular citizens like you and me, not self-serving media spinmeisters, wade through the barrage of newspeak and doublethink that pollutes public discourse today. Big Brother, big business, big media, and the big national parties who collude to keep we the people afraid and in the dark would prefer that you not watch. Show them who's in charge. Tune in to Escape from Orwellianation right here on Channel 10.
From Washington, back to the Inside Scoop with Mark Levine.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. We're discussing the Supreme Court's recent abortion decision. My guest on the phone is Judy Brown, the president of the American Life League. In studio here is Jim Southworth. He's the CEO of Channel 10, but he's coming here to tell a very different story. In 1981, Jim Southworth's wife was pregnant with what would have been her first child. But something terribly wrong happened. Jim, what happened?
Well, they said I beat the odds, and if I could have done that in Vegas, it would have been a lot better than what happened. There is a birth defect known as a trisomy 13. It has to do with the 13th chromosome. It's a very, very rare. In our case, they told us it was a 1.5 million birth. However, the situation it creates is extremely difficult. What happens is, in our case, and this was 1981, where some of the imaging technology and so on that's available today was not as readily available, but there was the technique called amniocentesis. And I'll talk more about that in a second. But this was our first child together, and the baby was born and lived for 5 days. But the baby had no brain. It had a brain stem. It had no liver, no kidneys. And a lot of other aspects of its internals had not developed much beyond the third month of development. Everything
basically
stopped.
So basically this disease, trisomy 13, means that a fetus develops up to about 3 months in utero and then stops.
The inside stops, but the outsides don't. So when the baby was born, it cried, it hungered, it moved.
But it had no brain, no liver, no kidneys.
No. Now, the complications get pretty ugly in other ways because at the time, until a baby is born, it's not alive as such, at least by the present definition of the law, and you can correct me on that.
Well, let me ask you this. Could you feed this child?
Every time we attempted to feed the child would go into convulsions.
Because it had no
stomach. The neurologically was not capable of dealing
with food.
It had a digestive system, a very crude digestive system, but that wasn't the issue. Neurologically, it couldn't deal with it. It went immediately into massive convulsions.
Let me ask you this. If a child is born with trisomy 13 today in 2007 with all the medical science we have today, could that child survive?
Same difference.
No, it could not. And even today, with our technology,
there's no organs.
There's no way that it could live. So it died of, I guess, hunger after 5 days.
Yeah, which brings us to the next point. About 32 hours after the birth, and a lot of gnashing of teeth, and some really traumatic times with the family and everything going on. I went to my priest, and I was a very practicing Catholic at the time. And I asked for his help because one of the things we found we had to do was when we recognized that the child couldn't feed, was I signed the necessary paperwork to allow the hospital, neonatology section, to basically not have to feed the child because there was.
Because if you put it in a feeding tube, it would still never have a brain.
Not only the discomfort, but the obvious problems from the massive convulsions and so on that took place. So they could withhold food. Within a matter of hours of my talking to my priest, the detectives from the D.C. Police Department showed up at the neonatology section at the hospital, and they got me on the phone as well, where a complaint had been sworn out against us for attempted murder.
Attempted murder?
Attempted murder.
For denying food to a brainless creature.
And the problem I had in this is this, you know, I've already, at this point, I've had a very, very traumatic situation.
Sure.
Psychologically traumatic in many ways for both my wife and I.
You had no idea this was going to be abnormal birth.
We had no way. In fact, even today, unless there's any suspicion of this, you would normally not do the necessary imaging that would image inside of the child, inside of the womb. And really, it's almost not detectable till, this is the most insidious part, the third trimester.
When there would be enough development that if it were an ordinary child,
right,
it would be a viable fetus.
And that's also the first point at which they can have some of the visibility necessary with the scanning and techniques that are available.
It's a horrific story, and certainly my sympathies go out to you and to your wife. But what does this have to do with partial birth abortion?
Well, had we known or had available or had any opportunity to have done an abortive situation and avoided the 5 days of hell that we lived through, and then the subsequent multiple weeks of hell till it was determined that they weren't going to press charges.
Wow. Attempted murder, that's pretty serious.
Yeah, and my work in government and security and things of that type, I would have been a felony conviction of any kind.
And again, even if you had fed this brainless human being,
there was no way it could survive. It had not the liver, the kidneys to keep its blood and other organs functional. Plus, there was no brain.
And it was undergoing convulsions that were very painful to the
creature. For obviously, yes.
Well, let me turn back to Judy Brown. Judy, you've heard Jim's story here. Do you think in extreme cases, and I think this, he said it's a 1.5 million shot, but in extreme cases where you have a fetus that's going to become a child, but actually not at all be like an ordinary child, a brainless, terminally ill from the moment of birth creature, what's your view on abortions in those rare circumstances?
Well, let me first say that even though you've used the term creature to describe this child who suffered terribly and whose parents suffered terribly, what the father of this child did, your guest Jim, was precisely what he should have done, and that is, once it was quite clear the situation and condition of the baby, he did the right thing. He went and spoke to his priest, and he took the priest's guidance, spiritual guidance and leadership. Where the problem comes in here, and excruciating suffering for this family, is this outrageous charge of attempted murder. That I do not understand, and as far as I'm concerned, that is inhumane and uncivilized. However, I do not believe that directly killing the child would have provided the family with any peace either. I would never see a reason to kill a child.
Well, let me ask you this, Jim. What would have been the difference between having a partial birth abortion, intact DNA, where you start to deliver the fetus through the legs, stab the skull? Certainly, I guess, would be less traumatic to your wife in terms. I mean, that's a traumatic event anyway.
Well, but except that we would have not seen any of that. That those are all medical procedures that basically we would not have been exposed to. First of all. Psychologically, the damage that we went through of my wife and I of holding a child that moved and cried,
even though like an ordinary child,
almost there was a cleft palate and some other obvious facial distortion issues that were part of the same syndrome, but obviously there was the trauma we went through afterwards would have been far less than what would have been. Not much more than in some respects, than a miscarriage.
Which is still traumatic for anyone. But not the same, especially
since we wanted children. We wanted the child very badly.
Did your wife say that she wished she could have had an abortion if she had, other than going through it?
We didn't know what, by the time we found out we had the problem, the baby had already been born. Now, the second child that we had together, we did amniocentesis.
Because why? Why?
Because the risk factor was there for repetition potentially. If this was something, if there was, they don't. It's so rare they don't know really what cause or factor otherwise.
They would check it.
If we'd have found we had the same thing, we would have attempted abortion.
My wife and I talked
about this, but we could not have lived through two. It was the hell that we went through. The biggest problem I had, Judy, was. When the person I trusted in, my priest, apparently called the diocese. And it was the diocese of Arlington that filed the complaint for attempted murder. That's where my problem comes from.
It's outrageous.
Yeah, that was my problem. It damaged my practicing my faith in many ways.
I feel so bad for your family. I just cannot possibly tell you. However, I must say that from what you described, the suffering of that baby and the guidance that was given to you by the priest was precisely correct. And I doubt that you'd have the same feelings about this today had you not gone through this excruciating double attack on your family. I mean, first of all, you had to deal with this poor baby who was not to survive, and then you had to deal with someone accusing you of attempted murder. I mean, that is just, I can't even imagine how much pain that caused you.
Well, even more so in one respect was the fact that we had an amazing doctor, Women's Hospital, who took incredible care of us with incredible sensitivity through all of this, and actually shielded us from some of the uglier parts of the problems with the police as much as he could. But he took almost a professional hit for this as well.
Judy, let me ask you this. If a family, a mother, or husband, discovers that they have this extremely rare, I mean, let's face it, we're talking about 1.5 million births, but they discover that this child will be born, but won't be like any ordinary child. It'll be terminally ill from birth, not be able to eat, not have a brain. Do you feel that abortion in that case is more justifiable than in the case of an ordinary child?
Are you talking to me?
Yes, I am.
No, you see, the problem with your question is it puts us human beings in the position of having to decide who is worthy of living and who is not. And I have known several parents who experienced diagnoses prenatally. And had they aborted their baby, as they were encouraged to do, perfectly normal children would have been killed. And that is one of the reasons why I think the imperfect state of medicine encourages me to believe that babies should be born. If they're born in a terminal condition, that's very, very sad. But many of these babies who are misdiagnosed who would have their lives taken away from them. And wouldn't that be sad? Which is one of the reasons why I think abortion is so immoral.
So it's basically due to the imperfections of medicine. What if this, you know, and again, I don't know the specifics. I'm no doctor of this, of amniocentesis and discovering, you know, the error rate.
Well, actually,
for this chromosome.
Well, today the imaging capabilities they have today can not only see into the womb, but they can see into the child. And as a result, they've done amazing things with fixing heart conditions and intestinal issues and things like that in the fetus before birth.
Right.
There have been amazing things done in that area. But unfortunately, even still, the major indications of problems of what we saw or what we had would probably have not have been significantly evident unless we were looking for it. Significantly evident until the third trimester. But here's the other aspect of this, Mark, and obviously I've had a very sensitive situation for a lot of years now and watched a lot of this. And the statistics I've heard, first of all, in my case, it was 1.5 million of this particular kind of problem. But my understanding is that the more drastic forms of abortion, and Judy, you might be able to correct me on this, that we're only practiced like 120 times in the entire United States all of last year, and most cases for a fetus that was already dead.
Well, that's a good question, and I want to address that question too, Judy Brown, when we come back. Folks, if you want to call in, it's easy to do, the toll-free number. Actually, best way to comment is right on the blog. Go to radioinsidescoop.com. A number of you have already commented already. This way I can read your comments on the air. And let us know what you think about what Jim says, what Judy says, and what the Supreme Court said just last week. We'll be right back after this.
This is Mommy's bed. Me and Jenny were jumping on it. Mommy's gun fell on the floor. I was a cowboy. Bang, 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 bang. I said, Jenny, wake up, wake up. It's just pretend. But she wouldn't wake up.
If you give me a fish...
If you give someone a fish...
You feed them for a day.
Teach someone to fish.
You feed them for a lifetime.
Give me a fish, and you'll feed me for a day. Teach me to fish, and you'll feed me for a lifetime.
Through Volunteers of America, you can help change lives in your community.
Oh, hey, mister. Studied algebra in school and got a better job than I could. You take the last cup.
Oh, no, mister. Stuck in an entry-level job because you only learned basic math. I don't have a boss riding my butt like you do, so you take it so you can get back to your desk.
You know, I probably should, but maybe Miss AP Calculus with the $200 haircut in the big office upstairs would like a cup.
Oh, no, Mr. What was your name again? Never mind, it doesn't matter. I'm too busy doing important things to care. I just came down for some sweetened start.
You know, if my limited math abilities weren't keeping me from getting a better job, I'd quit this afternoon.
I don't blame you. But thank goodness you're stuck here because we really need someone to make the coffee.
From Washington, back to the Inside Scoop with Mark Levine.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. We're discussing the recent Supreme Court abortion decision with Judy Brown, the president of the American Life Lobby, and Jim Southworth, who has his own personal story of tragedy to tell, and with you. And a number of you have commented already on the blog at RadioInsideScoop.com. Let's go to the blog and let's read some of these comments. This is from Vicky. Vicky writes, "While my sympathies are with Mr. and Mrs. Southworth, I really don't understand their reasoning in the situation. Regardless of what term is applied to the procedure, they still ended up with a dead child. If they would acknowledge what would actually be done to their child before birth, that would be agony as well. No easy solution to situations like this or many other situations in life." Vicky writes, "I can live with the fact that my child died by something outside of my control easier than knowing I was the one who chose to end his or her life." So Jim, Vicky's saying the child dies either way. Why would it provide more comfort for you to have an abortion rather than to let it die outside the womb?
Quite frankly, the problem was the very most basic one is one of legality. If the child terminated prior to birth, the child didn't exist legally from the standpoint of a potential murder conviction.
So let me ask you: apart from the I'm not saying I disagree with you.
Yeah.
But what I'm saying is, if there had not been this threat, I mean, indictment for attempted murder, which is extremely severe, let me ask you, just apart from that legal stuff, which Judy agrees, which I agree is atrocious, what about Vicky's point? Apart from in essence, why not let it be born and let it die of its own? Wouldn't that be easier on your conscience?
We did undergo this with the next child. One of the first things the doctors recommended to us and the psychologist, psychiatrist involved, basically was that we attempt to get pregnant again as quick as possible.
To heal the psychological stress.
Yes, and the emptiness from the loss of the child as much as possible. And we did, and we had an amazing now 6'3" ponytailed and steel-toed boot working in the entertainment industry in California son, who's been an amazing bright spot in my life and my wife's as well.
But Vicky's point is, why would, apart from the legal complications, which I know are atrocious, would it have mattered whether you had a partial birth abortion or actually had the birth? I mean, I know that when you have a birth, that's a traumatic experience as well. There's tearing. It's very painful.
The hell we went through was so intense. The disruption of our family life and many things, and communication between each other, and then the post-traumatic effects of all of that were cumulative.
We're
sure of that, but we made the decision consciously that if the amniocentesis that we did with my second, which, by the way, is at least back then was not a simple thing to do. It carried a very high risk of miscarriage.
Right, because you stick at that time, certainly, I don't know if it's true today, but you have to stick a needle all the way into the woman to grab some amniotic fluid from inside the womb, and that was a very dangerous procedure.
And the percentages were not good, but we went through the risk of that, but more, the risk of potentially having a second child of this type. And the hell that would have done to our marriage and our lives would have been
a dangerous procedure that could have caused a miscarriage so that you could have an abortion if you needed to rather than go through what you went the first
absolutely
time. Judy Brown, I want to go to some other comments on the blog, but if you want to comment, I want to give you a chance.
I just want to say that it seems that the main point that you have been discussing here with Jim is that if he had had a partial birth abortion for this child, a human being would not have been recognized, and therefore there would have been no crime. And that is the very fundamental reason why we oppose abortion, because abortion does kill a human being.
Okay, let me go on to other comments we have on the blog. These are comments by Robert, who writes, he's read Justice Ginsburg's dissent, and he points out that this is the first time the court is really interfering between a doctor and the mother, that they didn't interfere at the time of Justice Rehnquist getting drugs, but they're interfering in this case. Robert wants to know, why is it called partial birth abortion? Why did the Supreme Court call it that? Actually, Robert, the Supreme Court didn't call it that. Congress called it that. You're absolutely right that doctors don't use that term. They talk about DNE or intact DNE. And he wants to know that if charges can be filed against the woman. No, what the law does is it punishes the doctor, not the woman. The woman is exempt under the statute, but it punishes anyone that helps. So it could punish her husband, it could punish a doctor. Indeed, if a woman uses a coat hanger, it wouldn't punish her, but if anyone else did, that person could go to jail up to 2 years for performing a partial birth abortion. So that's what the law says. What's interesting is the Missouri law that would now become legal because of this Supreme Court decision actually puts a doctor in jail for life, life imprisonment for performing a partial birth abortion. Now, what's interesting in the decision is that Justice Kennedy actually admits in the decision that Congress, when Congress said that it's never medically necessary, Congress was wrong. Both Kennedy and Ginsburg agree that, in fact, sometimes many doctors think that it is more healthy for a woman to undergo this procedure. So, again, the fetus is killed either way, and for the first time in history, the court is upholding a regulation that says, in effect, a woman's health is not the primary goal. Sometimes we're going to put the method of killing a fetus ahead of a woman's health. Judy Brown, do you think that for that reason this law should never have been passed?
Well, you know, I've been involved with this debate for now for 15 years, ever since this bill was first considered. And the problem is Dr. Bernard Nathanson, who's a very famous obstetrician, who actually was an abortionist before he became a pro-life doctor, said this procedure, which would be the intact DNE, is actually an act of infanticide. It was not abortion. It is not abortion. And he said that the pro-life movement was making a fatal mistake by describing it as abortion.
Well, in your view, what's the difference between abortion and infanticide, since you think it's a human being, a child, a full life from conception? What's the difference in your view?
Well, look, if the only way to resolve this debate in a way that is fair to all the human beings involved is to outlaw abortion.
So did your organization support the Partial Birth Abortion Act of 2003, or was opposed to it, or took no position on it?
Our position on the Partial Birth Abortion Act of 2003 was quite simply that we opposed it because it had a life of the mother exception, which, as Justice Kennedy pointed out, it allowed the doctor to decide to perform this procedure if he said the life of the mother was threatened. That's ridiculous. It's contradictory, and we opposed it.
Would you have supported the legislation if it didn't have a life of the mother exception?
No, because I do not believe it was strategically a good idea for the pro-life movement to even get involved in this, and I'll tell you why. It created the impression in the public that there was such a thing as a very bad abortion, and the pro-life movement was recognizing that maybe all abortions aren't that bad, but this kind of an abortion was terrible. And I think that set a very bad precedent. Anybody who reads that Supreme Court decision would agree with me.
Now, does your organization differ from other pro-life organizations on this point?
Pardon me?
Does your organization, the American Life Lobby, differ from other pro-life organizations on this point? I mean, some pro-life organizations supported this bill, right?
Well, all we've done about this bill since it was first introduced 10 years ago was point out repeatedly that it was inconsistent for the pro-life movement to choose one kind of an abortion and oppose it when there were three other ways to kill this very same baby.
So you disagree with other pro-life organizations on this bill. Is that fair to say?
Oh, you bet.
Okay. What are the numbers? What kind of numbers are we talking about? Jim mentioned some numbers that he had heard, but we're not the experts here. What numbers, how many of these intact DNEs occur in America each year?
Well, according to the National Abortion Federation, there are more than 5,000 every year.
What if, now, is that intact DNEs?
Of intact DNE, yes.
Okay, just so our listeners understand, intact DNE is what Congress called personal birth abortion. That's what is currently banned, and banned nationwide. That's where they don't chop up the fetus, so they could pull it out intact, which leaves less damage to the woman's uterus. Those are the ones, these 5,000, that will now be banned. Now, one thing that Congress's law does is very interesting, because pro-life advocates have argued that Roe v. Wade should not have been a constitutional decision, that at least some have, and I'm not really talking about Judy Brown here, but I know that many have argued this should be state by state, that New York may want to allow more easy access to abortions, while Mississippi might want to prohibit them entirely, and we should be allowed in our federal system to have state-by-state choice. Interestingly, Congress, in this regard, has made a national law. So partial birth abortions, as they've defined them, would be banned not just in Mississippi, but in New York as well. And I'm curious to know from you, Judy, whether that is a dangerous precedent, because it seems to me that what Congress give, Congress can take it away. If Congress can pass a law nationwide that decides any issue on abortion, they could have passed a nationwide pro-choice law as well as a nationwide pro-life law. I wonder what your view is on that, on the federal versus state-by-state aspect of this.
Well, in that regard, I agree with many Americans who say that what the Congress has done sets a dangerous precedent at several levels. If we experience in 2 years a democratically controlled Congress and a Democrat in the White House, it would be very simple for Congress to go back, pass a new law, restore rights to partial birth abortion, have the president sign it, and we'd be right back where we started.
In fact, Congress could even go further and make Roe v. Wade part of our national legislation. What's interesting is that conservatives often complain about the powers of the federal government. And many conservatives, and this is really, I'm not talking pro-choice or pro-life here, but sort of people who believe in federalism, people who believe in states' rights, have argued that this should be a state-by-state decision. By conservatives praising this Supreme Court decision, as most have, what they're saying, in effect, is they recognize that Congress has the right to regulate this. That's an open question. The Constitution clearly doesn't give the Congress a clear right to regulate abortion, but it's used under the Commerce Clause and all kinds of things. If Congress can do this, Judy Brown is absolutely right. What they give, they can take away, and they can actually codify Roe v. Wade in the law, and then it wouldn't matter who's appointed to the Supreme Court. When we come back, I want to talk about, actually, my own mother. Sorry, Mom. I don't think she'd mind, though. She's been quite public about a pregnancy that she had between my sister and me and what happened to her. It's interesting to me. I don't think people talk about these issues a lot. Most of my friends and family don't know the story of my mother. I've known Jim now for 3 years. I didn't know that story. I think these things are a bit more common than people want to talk about or do talk about. So I'm glad that I'm both outing Jim and my own mother tonight. If you want to write in, it's easy to do. Just go to the blog, radioinsidescoop.com. Give me your comments. We'll read them on the air. We'll be right back after this.
I, George Walker Bush, do solemnly swear that I will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States and will, to the best of my ability, preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States. So help me God.
Let's impeach the President for life.
My name is David Bell. I am a resident of Virginia's 11th Congressional District, and I ask Representative Tom Davis to initiate or support an investigations into violations of the law by President Bush and his administration.
Tom Davis, my name is Jean Reynolds, and I'm one of your constituents. I want you to join immediately with other members of Congress to begin an investigation of the criminal acts that George Bush has committed.
I'm Nick Spengler of Ashland, Virginia, and I would like our troops to come home and Bush to get out of office.
My name is Nancy Maynard. I live in the 11th Congressional District, and this message is for Tom Davis. I'm asking you to please investigate for impeachment.
My name is Bruce Smith. I live in the 11th Congressional District in Woodbridge, Virginia. I want Congressman Davis to support the investigation of President Bush and Vice President Cheney and those that foisted this war on us.
Hello, Congressman Davis. I'm Carrie Plonson from the 11th Congressional District, and I'd like you to take immediate action to investigate George Bush and his offenses in leading this country into a war that's unwarranted and there is no solution for.
We have to impeach. I am just appalled that we would not, quote, waste our time with impeachment. The message to the world has to be that Bush and Cheney are guilty of international war crimes about which we can't do anything. We can do a lot about the crimes committed within the U.S. Constitution.
From Washington, back to the Inside Scoop with Mark Levine.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. We're reviewing the recent Supreme Court decision on the Partial Birth Abortion Act of 2003 with the president of the American Life Lobby on the phone. Her name is Judy Brown. She's been working on these issues for more than 15 years, as she said. And by the way, you can link to her website from my website at radioinsidescoop.com. Sitting to my right is Jim Southworth, who conveyed his own story of tragedy in 1981, where he wishes that his wife could have had a partial birth abortion. And she wishes she could have had it as well. I want to read from the dissent. Justice Ginsburg wrote a blistering dissent to the Supreme Court opinion. I have it up here on the computer. And by the way, all of this stuff is publicly available. And I would encourage you to read some of this stuff. I learned a lot, frankly, from both the opinion and the dissent. Here's what she writes. She writes, intact DNA, plaintiff experts explain, provides safety benefits over DNA by dismemberment for several reasons. First, she writes, intact DNA minimizes the number of times a physician must insert instruments through the cervix and into the uterus, and thereby reduces the risk of trauma to and perforation of the cervix and the uterus, the most serious complication associated with non-intact DNA. Second, removing the fetus intact instead of dismembering it in utero decreases the likelihood that the fetal tissue will be retained in the uterus, a condition that can cause infection, hemorrhage, and infertility. Third, intact DNA diminishes the chances of exposing the patient's tissues to sharp, bony fragments, sometimes resulting from dismemberment of the fetus. Fourth, intact DNA takes less operating time than DNA by dismemberment and thus may reduce bleeding, the risk of infection, and complications relating to anesthesia. Ginsburg also points out that poor women can't pay for some of the more expensive hospitalization procedures. And she also goes on and talks about the proposition that Judy Brown mentioned, that Justice Kennedy mentioned, about why not poison the fetus or stab it in the heart, kill the fetus in utero. And she points out that, this is in footnote 6, I have it right here on the screen, a significant body of medical opinion believes that inducing fetal death by injection is almost always inappropriate to the preservation of the health of women undergoing abortion because it poses tangible risk and provides no benefit to the woman. In some circumstances, injections are absolutely medically contraindicated. It also requires a hospital stay, rendering it inaccessible to patients who lack financial resources. It, too, is considered less safe for many women. The other alternative, which would be medical induction. In other words, forcing the woman to have, to induce labor, even though the fetus is 3 or 4 or 5 months premature, that causes a hospital stay and is less safe for many women. So what Justice Ginsburg is saying, look, we know that you're going to have an abortion anyway, and of course Judy Brown is opposed to any abortions, but if you're going to have an abortion anyway, and the fetus is going to die anyway, shouldn't we allow the procedure that is most safe for the woman? I mean, the fetus is going to, if there's concerns about the woman's health and the fetal health, the fetus is going to die either way. Why not at least provide, if the fetus is going to die either way, the procedure that doctors think is safest for the woman? It's a pretty powerful argument, and I wonder whether even very strong pro-life advocates like Judy Brown might agree with it. Judy, what do you think?
I'm going to tell you what I think about this. I agree with the American Medical Association. I agree with the vast majority of OBGYNs. There is never a circumstance during which this intact DNA should be performed.
But you don't think there's never ever a circumstance where non-intact DNA should be performed?
Pardon me?
I mean, just to be fair, the American College of Gynecologists, for example, says the intact DNA is safer than the non-intact DNA. I know that you don't want intact DNAs ever to be performed, but to be fair, you don't want non-intact DNAs to ever be performed because you don't want any abortion to ever be performed.
That's correct.
So my question is, assuming what you hate, and I know you hate it, but assuming an abortion is going to be performed, shouldn't at least it be done in a way that is safest for the health of the woman? Should we at least take a woman's health into consideration there?
It would be totally contradictory for me to answer this question that you're asking me in a positive way, because I am not going to agree that a single abortion for any reason is ever acceptable.
Let me ask you about, you said that your organization would not have supported an exception for the life of the mother.
Right.
Explain your views on that.
We have agree with all of the doctors who have supported our view, and there are many, many such doctors, that there is never a reason to perform an abortion to save the life of the mother. Medical practice has become so efficient that there's just not a reason to take the life of the preborn child in order to somehow help the mother. There's just no reason for it.
Well, you know, it's very interesting. There was a time in America and around the world where one out of six women died in childbirth. Indeed, the leading cause of death to women of childbearing age around the world was childbirth for many, many, many years. I think I want to talk about a situation involving my own mother. So, again, I don't think my mom would mind. She's talked about it before. 1 year prior to my birth, after my sister was born, my mother had what, in medical terms, and I hope I don't mangle this, is called a hydatidiform mole. Basically, yes. What it is, as I understand it, and I admit to not being a doctor, is the woman's body thinks it's pregnant. There actually is a miscarriage, but the woman's body still thinks it's pregnant. And the womb grows, the uterus grows, there is a placenta that grows, all to feed an infant that's not there. There's nothing inside. It's a blank, it's an empty womb. And yet everything grows, and it's quite dangerous to the woman. And, of course, there's no fetus there, so I don't think there are any abortion concerns. But my mom became very, very violently ill until, actually, she had to undergo, 4 months into this pregnancy, an emergency cesarean section. An abortion couldn't have cleaned out. They had to clean out all these moles, if you will, all these pieces in her uterus to do that. Afterwards, and this is back in the 1960s, so this is clearly a different medical time. Afterwards, when I was born, a year later, the doctors actually think that that due to the earlier birth, it made my birth extremely traumatic for my mother. After I was born, in fact, my mother bled so much that she had to undergo a full-body blood transfusion. In other words, she lost every drop of blood in her body, but there were blood transfusions. Thankfully, there wasn't AIDS in those days, although you could get all kinds of other diseases. And she was able to get enough blood to save her life. She almost died when I was born, and that was obviously a very difficult thing. She also had to have an emergency hysterectomy so that she could have no children after I was born. I only point this out to point out that the birth problems are very common. And now, I don't know, and I don't claim to be an expert on this, to the extent that these problems still occur today. I would think the problems have to occur today. Judy Brown's point of view is that doctors are so good today that there's never a circumstance where a woman's life is in danger by having a child. I'd be very surprised by that, because I know, not just from the experts in the Supreme Court opinion, but from all women's advocacy groups and from stories that I hear, that there are still circumstances today where you do have to make a choice. I mean, it's not just, you know, in the movies where they show cases where a doctor sometimes has to make a choice between a woman's life and a fetus's life. And I guess what comes down to it, Judy, is if a doctor has to make that choice where a woman may well die if a fetus is to be born, is it your view that the fetus is of equal value to the woman in that regard?
Yes. Well, let me explain it to you this way. Even in the case of your mother in the 60s, the doctor who is truly ethical and proficient in the practice of medicine would do everything he possibly could to save the lives of both the mother and the baby.
There's no question.
If he lost the baby.
There's no question that a doctor should try to do both. My question is that terrible Hobson's choice where a doctor has to make a decision. I know there are times, for example, and I was just talking, in fact, with a gynecologist, where a woman's body is immunosuppressed when she's pregnant, meaning that because there's another creature in there with a different genetic code, another fetus, the woman's body is naturally more immunosuppressed so it doesn't reject the baby. But that also means the woman's more likely to catch a disease. And this doctor told me that if a woman had cancer or other kinds of diseases, that the fetus can actually starve the woman through this immunosuppression of the antibodies she needs to save her own life. And I guess my question is, at the end of the day, if there has to be a choice, are you saying that the fetus's life is equal to the mother's and a doctor should not make that choice and just let be what'll be, even if the fetus lives and the mother dies?
Look, one of the cases you're describing is a cancerous womb. And I can tell you right now that if that baby living within a cancerous womb, that baby is going to die. If the doctor avoids, ignores, or whatever, doing something about this, he's going to lose both of his patients. I mean, this is a question that employs common sense. It has nothing to do with abortion.
Well, Judy Brown, I want to thank you very much for coming here and for giving your views. I really do appreciate it. I hope that I've educated a lot of people. I know I've educated myself, frankly, just by reading this opinion. I had no idea before I did the different methods of abortion. There are some gruesome things here. There's no question about it. But in my view, you have to look at the life of the mother, the health of the mother. She's existed some 20, 30, 40 years. She's been on this earth. As terrible as the incident that happened to Jim Southworth, they could have another child. He did have another child. A wonderful kid, and at the end of the day, when it comes to the health of the mother, I'm concerned by a U.S. Supreme Court that says that anything is more important than the health of a woman as decided by her and her doctor. That's it for the Inside Scoop. This is Mark Levine signing off.